Okay, we have two arguments this morning. And we'll hear the first one now. This is appeal number 22-1211, In Re Yu. So, Mr. Yu, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, my name is Stephen Yu.
Okay, Mr. Yu, can you please come to the lectern? And before you begin, are you reserving any time for rebuttal?
5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay, very good. Okay, please begin.
This case is not about the complexity of what the prior art says. There's no dispute about that. This case is about what is the claim scope. I say it's narrow. The patent office says it's broad. I addressed everything I wanted to say in my written briefs. I only have two more comments to bring to this oral argument. The first is, how does the patent office want applicants to write claims for standalone machine invention? For example, a car comprising an engine, four wheels, a drive shaft, a gearbox. It used to be you could just say that, you know, just list the elements. But do I now have to say the engine is physically part of the car? Also, the wheels are physically part of the car. Oh, and also, a drive shaft is physically part of the car.
Why didn't you amend Claim 3 to expressly require the control system to be physically on board the vehicle?
The examiner wouldn't allow it.
You tried to make the amendment?
Well, I asked her in the examiner amendment, would you allow? I'll just write it on board if that's what you want. She said it's not part of the disclosure.
Okay. Is that...
So I'm talking about this... It's a machine claim. It's.
Is that somewhere in the record? This dialogue with you and the examiner.
I think it's part of the appeal briefing. One of the appeal briefs.
Oh gosh.
Do you have a page citation?
I don't have the appeal. Well, the PTAB briefs with me, but the word "on board" is in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think. I think I suggested it or she suggested it, but the outcome was that. You can't put that in there because it's not explicitly written in the specification. I'd love to.
Okay. The PTO brief, I believe, comes up with a different analogy, one with a television, and a television that comes with a remote control. I didn't see a response to that in your gray brief.
Can we
say that a remote control is part of a television, even though the remote control is not physically integrated with the actual television console?
That's a system claim. You have a television, standalone television, which is a machine, and a standalone remote control, which you can claim separately if that's a novel invention. But that's an article of manufacture, a system comprising a television and a remote control and wireless communication with the television for controlling the television.
What if the remote control was connected with a wire to the television?
Well,
so you have the television set, right? And then you have a wire and then you're holding the remote control. Would that be, in your view, okay that to regard the remote control as part of the television in that scenario?
Yes.
Okay. Because of the wire.
Well, it's physically.
Right. But, so, I guess that's the distinction you're making. A wired connection is okay, but a wireless connection is not okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, it's not a machine. Well, it's not part of the same standalone machine.
Your specification talks about an operations hub that is remote from the vehicle and there's a radio communications equipment that is physically a part of that vehicle that is in communications with the operations hub, and then the operations hub is described as having the ability to do certain kinds of control functions, including monitoring the vehicle. is that a way to regard perhaps, is that perhaps a disclosure that shows that perhaps through a wireless connection, through radio communications equipment, the vehicle is, the operations hub is in a way serving the control system element of the claimed vehicle?
It is, but I call it a system claim. I say in the specification, in the summary, a system comprising, not a machine, a system comprising, or some kind of controls, a system comprising an operations hub, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. The remote from that is the car, is the vehicle machine. So that's a system claim, which is an article of manufacture.
Your claim reads as a vehicle comprising a system.
Yes.
So there is the system, you actually claim a system, then why can't it, under your argument, have an external function? The control system that you are talking about is programmed for autonomous driving.
It can be external if it's wired, but if it's remote, that's not a machine under the logical analysis.
It's a system that's part of a machine.
Yeah, that's
a
part of the
machine. The autonomous vehicle is the machine, correct? In the claim.
That is the machine. The rest of it, a system is an article of manufacture, which is, one remote component and another remote component.
My point is that your argument seems to be that the only circumstance in which we can consider an element that's external to the structure is if it's in a system, not in a machine claim.
That's what the precedent says.
Right, but your very claim is claiming a control system.
Well, that is part of... Well, it is...
That's part of a machine.
Well, I can call it something. It's... That doesn't make it a system. That one element being a system, a computer system having computer chips, a control system is computer chip, radio, wireless communication, memory.
What you're saying is that any machine that has a control system in it converts the machine to a system.
That's what the patent office is saying. I'm not saying that.
Well, I'm simple-minded, but I'm confused because you're claiming a vehicle,
yeah.
Right?
Yes.
And the vehicle has within it a number of things. That's what a comprising language means. So among the things that the vehicle has in it, the vehicle has a cargo compartment, power source, keypad, all these things. It also has in it a system.
Yes, but it does, but it doesn't make that one element does not make the whole claim a system. For example, a car can have a radio system. A car can have a GPS system. But that doesn't make the car itself, the car is still a machine, not an article of manufacture.
But the system that exists within the vehicle, the system can have external components.
Well, in this case,
it's only the machine that can't have, in your theory, that can't have external parts.
Well, if the machine constrains everything, the whole body of the claim, then the control system cannot have any remote components. I mean, it's a vehicle, which is a machine, which is constrained as standalone, and my reasoning is anything that is part of any subsequent element is also self-contained because it's part of the machine. Otherwise, it should have said a vehicle system. But I didn't say that. I said it's just a vehicle, a standalone vehicle. So that just by that, it constrains the control system from not having remote elements.
Do you agree that the in connection with language signals remote control? Do you agree with that statement?
Please say again.
Do you agree with the statement that in connection with could signal a possibility of remote control? Do you agree with that?
Yes.
You do?
In connection with? Yeah.
Would you like to save the rest of your time for rebuttal?
Yes. Or is it, I have 5 minutes?
Yeah, you still have 5.5 minutes, roughly.
Okay.
That includes your 5-minute rebuttal time that you want to reserve.
I'll just finish it here. I'll just leave no rebuttal time. The Patent Office says this is a BRI issue. It's not. And, for the Patent Office, BRI is a flexible fallback when it has no other counterargument. There's a much more fundamental problem in their analysis. But even if we look at this from a BRI perspective, if you're looking at this, if you read a claim to cross over into a different statutory category, that's kind of unreasonable. That's unreasonable when you claim crosses a statutory boundary. For example, if a BRI turns a composition claim into a machine claim, that is unreasonable. I'll save the rest of it if I need to follow.
Okay, thank you.
May it please court, William Lamarca from the PTO. I guess I have one comment in response to appellant's position, Your Honor, on the claim construction. If we look at claim three.
Before we get into that, can I just ask about, I don't know how familiar you are with the prosecution history for this examination, but is it true that the examiner somehow objected to Mr. Yu's attempt to amend the claims to add an onboard limitation to the control system?
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that, Your Honor. It wasn't, as far as I know, it wasn't argued in any of the briefs here, and I don't remember seeing it in the prosecution history. I'm not saying that didn't happen. I think it sounds like what he's saying is maybe the examiner said there might not have been written description support for that feature, and I really can't speak to that because when you do read the specification, it talks about both onboard and offboard control. It doesn't talk about exclusive onboard control, which I think is what he's trying to claim. He wants it to be only an onboard control system and no controls can come from anywhere else. But if you read his own disclosure, his disclosure says that the controls can be onboard, but they can also be offboard.
Well, I guess, as I understand his argument, is that there is this remote control thing called an operations hub. But in addition to that, there's a vehicle that's out there in the field. And the vehicle itself has a control system that can autonomously drive the vehicle, but can also autonomously monitor things about the vehicle's condition. That doesn't take away from the fact that there's also a supplemental control system at the operations hub that could override the vehicle's control system if there's some kind of emergency. But nevertheless, the vehicle itself also has its own control system. And so what I'm wondering is, why isn't there written description support for that based on what is described here about the vehicle having its own control system?
It doesn't sound like there is to me, but I mean, I wasn't privy to the conversation that he had with the examiner, and I don't know specifically what the examiner was referring to. However, I'd just like to point out the prior art has exactly what you just described. Mm-hmm. The prior art, I think the Zini reference does have onboard control for autonomous control of a vehicle, and it also has a remote host for intervening when there's a problem.
But the rejection here is not based on any kind of onboard control system from Zini's teachings, right? It's purely based on the idea that Zini has something called a remote host, and that's the control system.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think I know the reason for that.
Because
I kind of studied that over the weekend in my spare time.
This would be helpful. Okay.
And if you look at the claim,
let's
first look at the claim, claim three. If you look at the inside cover of the red brief, we've got it reproduced there. It says the autonomous vehicle, claim one, further comprising a control system that is programmed for autonomous driving, number one, of the vehicle on a roadway, and to monitor condition of the vehicle and to assess technical problems. If you look at the Zini reference, what you'll find is, indeed, Zini speaks all over the place about autonomous control. It has an onboard processor. It has an onboard controller for autonomous driving. However, when it assesses technical problems, that aspect it does remotely. So I think maybe that's why the examiner focused on that aspect of Zini, where there's the remote host that could pick up data when there's a problem, assess the problem, do analysis, and then step in if necessary. Right. So I think that could be the reason why the rejection's written that way.
So the onboard control system in Zini is dedicated purely to the self-driving function. It has nothing to do with monitoring conditions of the vehicle itself. And that's why the rejection is based on relying on the remote host.
I think that's correct, okay. Your Honor. Yeah, and I think that's why it's written the way it is. So, however, when you go look at appellant's own specification at page 32 of the appendix, for example, you'll see when they talk about the technical problems, which is the phrase we're referring to in the claim of claim 3, assessing technical problems, look at page 33 of the appendix. Between lines 19 and 25, and if you read that little...
This is A32?
Yeah, appendix 32. It says, I'll take you there right now, and I'm right at line 19, and it says, detection and or response to the problem, and if you look at the heading, technical problems, that's what they're talking about, may be performed autonomously or semi-autonomously. For example, the vehicle may detect and assess the technical problem on its own and find a safe parking on its own, or the problem may be assessed at the operations hub and the operations hub commands or guides the vehicle to a safe parking area, which means the claim language in claim 3 reasonably encompasses both self-control as well as external control. And I think the spec itself supports that reading. So I think the board's reading that the claim is got reasonable breadth to encompass both independent, autonomous onboard control as well as external controls, that's a reasonable reading, and that encompasses the prior art Zini reference. And I think that's where the agency really is on this point. And I think Mr. Yu is correct. The case kind of boils down to claim construction here. That's really what our dispute is about.
So, given the board's reasoning here, is there any difference between a machine claim and a system claim?
I don't think the differences that Mr. Yu has pointed out really exist. I think if you go back and look at, for example, the old, I think, 1890 Robinson treatise that he cited, I went and actually pulled that off the shelf. Luckily, we had a copy. And I read the exact quote that he cited to, and that quote is not about external components. That quote's more about an eligibility issue, if you go read it. In fact, so I don't think this distinction between it necessarily being a strict system claim or a machine claim is really an issue here. Here, clearly, we have a machine, we have an autonomous vehicle, but within the claim, claim 3, there's a control system, and the control system controls that vehicle. But nothing in that claim limits it to the location of the control system. And I think that's his argument here.
If we had a spaceship that went off to the moon and it's being controlled by a station on Earth.
Houston.
Say at Houston. Is that base station in Houston part of the spaceship?
I would say it's part of the spaceship's control system, but not part of the spaceship itself. For example...
Okay, so then that's an example where it would be unreasonable to extend out the meaning of a spaceship to encompass the Houston base station.
Agreed. But keep in mind what the claim says. If the claim would have said a controller on the autonomous vehicle, it doesn't say that. It says a control system that controls the vehicle. That's what it says. It doesn't say on the vehicle there's a controller, like a physical device. That would have been a little bit different, I think. It would have been structurally something that was on the device. Here, what it says, there's a control system that can be programmed. And yeah, part of that may be sitting on the autonomous vehicle. You can program it, and it's going to help the vehicle autonomously drive, and it's also going to help the vehicle assess technical problems, and it's going to also help monitor the condition of the vehicle. And the specification itself says that that monitoring and that assessing can take place either on the vehicle or at the remote base station, I guess the hub, the operations hub. So I think a reasonable reading of the way this claim is written, it encompasses both. It's not limited to one. So I agree with your spaceship example. The spaceship's the spaceship. But the control system could include controls that are on board as well as remote controls. And you gave a good example, I guess, with a TV. If it were wired, the controller could still be remote. You could still sit in your recliner and switch the channels with a wired controller, and that would be physically connected. But now we make it wireless, and you have the same controller in your hand, wirelessly transmitting data to the TV to control it. I don't see
why is it remote?
Yeah,
it's connected to the TV with a wire. Why is it remote?
Yeah, I mean, because you're able to sit away from the TV and make your controls. Let's go back to like the 1960s when they didn't have wireless remote controls, but you could have had a wire for power, for on and off, and a power, an extension essentially to allow you to control the TV. It would be part of the control system. I don't think the fact that there's a wire or that it's wireless changes the way we are going to evaluate that claim, Your Honor. I think that, and I think Mr. Yu's view is it should change the way we evaluate the claim. And I just don't think that's the agency's view here on claim construction. And it's true, there are things that we call system claims, which are, for example, a network of computers. They're networked together. They could be networked wired together. We could have five computers connected by hard wires, or they could be wirelessly linked. It's still a network of computers. It's still a system. We just don't make the hardcore distinction that Mr. Yu's making here on claim construction. We don't read this claim more narrowly or more broadly based on whether it's deemed a system or not.
So the focus has been on claim 3. Do you contend this court needs to take any action with respect to any of the other claims besides claim 3?
Yeah, I guess our view on that is that he hasn't argued those rejections of those other claims. And because they haven't been argued, the claims are still rejected. So even if the court weren't to say anything about them, when we went back to the agency, they would still be rejected claims. They wouldn't be reversed.
Well, is it a question of argued? I mean, Rule 15, FRAP, says that the notice of appeal specifies the order or part thereof to be reviewed. Right?
Right.
And, I mean, at least Rule 3, which is the analog for appeals, notice of appeal from district courts, it's a jurisdictional structure. And so I was reading Rule 15 AC, specify the order or part thereof to be reviewed, is limits what's in front of us.
Yeah, arguably those.
If you look at his notice of appeal, he doesn't specify that he only wants Claim 3 to be reviewed. And so it seemed to me that the entirety of the order from which he's appealed is in front of us. And then the normal waiver arguments kick in when somebody simply doesn't make an argument.
And that's what we put in our brief, that he didn't make arguments with respect to those claims, and he therefore forfeited.
Well, you didn't tie it in your brief to, right. In essence, Rule 15 problem.
We did not.
going to a jurisdictional issue.
What we did was just make our standard, argument that we typically make when an appellant doesn't argue a particular set of claims, and we basically say that argument's either been waived or forfeited.
Do we have jurisdiction to reach the other claims?
I guess that's a tougher question. It sounds like what you're telling me from the rule, Your Honor, and I don't want to speak where I'm not 100% sure, but it sounds like you're saying the whole case is in front of you because of the rule. And because he didn't distinguish that in the notice of appeal, they are in front of you. But then because they weren't argued in the blue brief, you can rule on them.
So they're in front of us. And then the question is, well, for whatever reason, I don't quite understand why Mr. Yu feels this way, because if we don't pass on, say, claim 1, for example, the patent office has rejected it. And that's binding on him, so he's cooked with regard to that claim. He's not going to get another chance to come back. So I don't know.
That's our view.
I don't know what the real world effect is, but it seems to me that if we have jurisdiction, if it's in front of us, and we decide, oh, well, because Mr. Yu wants us to discard our normal rules, which would be that we would say he's waived any opposition and you prevail and we affirm on the merits, if we if we decide to waive for him, what's the standard we use in the next case?
Right.
How do we decide who to give the card to, the pass? And I don't know the answer to that.
And I have to admit, I didn't give that level of sophistication to this, because the way I saw it when I picked up the case is, here are some claims that were not argued, here are rejections that weren't argued, waiver slash forfeiture, that's the way I looked at it.
The reason I'm concerned about it is
right.
That Rule 3 on, excuse me, on appeals from district courts used to read exactly the same as Rule 15 does now, but 2 or 3 years ago it was amended because it was a trap for the unwary. People didn't know exactly what they had to do to specify a piece of the appeal and non-specify.
Right.
And so that rule was changed to make it quite clear that basically the entire case is in front
right.
of an appellate court, unless there is a very specific delineation of the piece that's taken out. Now, that very specific delineation requirement that's now in Rule 3 is not in Rule 15. So Rule 15 goes back to the earlier stages.
I think from a practical standpoint, the point you're making to me is that when we first saw the notice of appeal, we assumed everything was on appeal. But then when the blue brief came in, that's the first time we realized rejections
really
weren't being argued.
To be accurate, when the notice of appeal was filed, the notice of appeal cites the entirety, says the decision. And the first docketing statement made by Mr. Yu repeated that. His docketing statement was rejected because it failed to name a second party. You then came in with your docketing statement, and you said specifically you want clear review of claims 1 to 18, 20, and the rest.
Right.
So he was on notice
sure.
that you were, in essence, saying the entire record in front of us. He then filed an amended declaration that went back saying the whole case, wants the whole case.
And then we didn't think of waiver or forfeiture until the blue brief came in. That's the first time. I was the lawyer working on it. That's the first time that ever came into my mind, was at the time of the blue brief. Prior to that, we believed everything was in front of the court. And that's not uncommon for it to happen that way. I mean, that's kind of very common, where an appellant just says, I'm seeking review of the board's decision of all the rejected claims. And then when the brief comes in, they choose to just limit their arguments to a certain portion. And we then point out the rest of those things have been waived or forfeited. That's very typical to the way it works from our perspective. It's just, you've asked me a question that's really beyond my knowledge level, and I don't really want to answer because I don't want to be inaccurate. Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Yu, still have some time remaining.
Could you just pick up on the dialogue we were having with Mr. LaMarca on which rejected claims are before us today?
Claim
on
three.
Appeal.
Just claim three.
Just claim three, and I suppose the claims that depend from claim three?
There may be.
Okay.
I don't remember, but not
so
claim
in,
one.
Not
I'm not going to waste this court's time on
okay.
other
Your docketing statement didn't specify which rejected claims you were seeking to appeal. Your docketing statement, when you filed your notice of appeal, just indicated that you wished to appeal the decision by
yes.
the Patent Board. So there's, you know, one reasonable reading of that is that you're appealing all of the board decision that was adverse to you as to each and every single one of the rejected claims.
That would have been a big brief and a lot of reading. I avoided that,
okay.
my decision.
Well, the reason why I had a concern, Mr. Yu, is that the rule which governs the issue, the rule states that the petition for review shall specify the order or part thereof to be reviewed. That's the law. And so I would assume that if you only wanted claim three to be reviewed, your notice of appeal would have identified claim three as a part of the order that you wanted reviewed. So I in fairness to the other side as well, our rules provide a form for you for a notice of appeal, and the form doesn't provide an option for how you can designate a part. And so I can understand why in this notice of appeal you, in essence, copied our form by identifying the decision that's available.
And Mr. Yu, if you want, you're allowed to take your mask off during argument. You don't have to. No pressure, but it's up to you.
I have 2 minutes. I did want to...
Yeah, please, go ahead.
I disagree that this is a claim construction issue. There's a more fundamental problem here. That's not recognizing distinct classes with inventions in statute 101. This is not claim construction. This is the 21st century. I know maybe old-fashioned machine claims aren't a commercial thing anymore. But patent applicants still need to have some way of claiming a standalone machine without this mess of accessory words having to say physically part of. And the statutory classes provided a way to do that simply, that now the patent office wants to take away, combine those two classes, statutory classes. So now it's taking away one of the statutory classes. I have nothing further.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Yu. The case is submitted.